You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe, New Mexican. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. In early December, Donald Trump did something that no United States president had ever done before. He shrank the size of a designated national monument. The monument is Bears Ears in Utah, which had been established by President Barack Obama. The reduction cut over 1 million acres and left only 15% of the original land under protection. Although Secretary of the Interior Ryan Zinke and others in the Trump administration said that mining interest played no role in the decision, the Washington Post reported that a company called Energy Fuels Resources had urged the Trump administration to shrink the size of the monument so that they could have easier access to uranium and other minerals, and they hired a team of lobbyists to assist in that effort. The move to shrink the monument is now facing legal challenges, and we will keep you up to date on that story. Meanwhile, the question of why national monuments and public lands are so important and what happens when they're threatened is a very deep one. Award-winning author Terry Tempest Williams wrote a book that came out last year called The Hour of Land, A Personal Topography of America's National Parks. And in the book, she takes you on a journey that's deep and surprising and harrowing and magical. Her stories of our national parks are in many ways the story of our country in all its greatness and awfulness, and of our soul as a country, which we seem to have to keep reminding ourselves is about a lot more than economics. The book was written during the Obama administration. On the morning after Election Day 2016, she wrote a poem, and this is Terry Tempest Williams reading that poem, Erosion.
Erosion. It is morning. I am morning, and the river is before me. I am a writer without words who is struggling to find them. I am holding the balm of beauty, this river, this desert, so vulnerable, all of us. I am trying to shape my despair into some form of action, but for now I am standing on the cold edge of grief. We are staring at a belligerent rejection of change by our fellow Americans, who believe they have voted for change. The seismic shock of a new political landscape is settling. For now, I do not feel like unity is what is called for. Resistance is our courage. Love will become us. The land holds us still. Let us pause and listen and gather our strength with grace and move forward like water in all its manifestations. Flat water, white water, rapids and eddies, and let us flood this country with an integrity of purpose and patience and persistence capable of cracking stone. I am a writer without words who continues to believe in the vitality of the struggle. Let us hold each other close and be kind. Let us gather together and break bread. Let us trust that what is required of us next will become clear in time. What has been hidden is now exposed. This river, this morning, this moment, may we be brave enough to feel it deeply, and then act.
That was Terry Tempest Williams with a poem that she wrote on Wednesday, November 9th, 2016, sitting on the edge of the Colorado River. In the conversation you're about to hear, we're also talking to Terry's husband, Brooke Williams, about his book, Open Midnight, Where Ancestors and Wilderness Meet. It's a very personal book about wilderness, ancestors, and what it's like to be out on the land with your dog and the spirits of the past. Welcome, Terry Tempest Williams and Brooke Williams.
Thank you.
It's so great to see you again.
It's great to have you back. I had no idea until I read this book, The Hour of Land, that our national parks could really tell the story of our country in such a deep and wide-ranging way. You write at the beginning of the book, this is a book about relationships, and as readers, we're traveling with you into the relationships among wilderness and family, war, energy, ancestors, native people. How did this book come to be? Did you have a sense of its scope when you began?
I absolutely did not, nor would I have ever taken this on. You know, I thought, oh, this will be the easiest book ever, because as a Utahn, you know, My entire life, I thought our national parks were our backyard, especially as a child growing up, where Zion, Bryce, Capitol Reef, Arches, Canyonlands National Parks were where we played as children. And now Brooke and I live adjacent to Arches National Park and a stone's throw away from Canyonlands. So, you know, to me, our national parks are a gateway drug into our public lands. And as you know, as a Westerner, especially in the American Southwest, our public lands are under siege. So I thought that for the centennial year of the National Park Service, this would be a wonderful way to look at our public lands as our public commons. What I didn't know is that in thinking about our national parks, it would become really an exploration of America. And I have to tell you, Mary Charlotte, I fell madly in love with our country.
You said at a certain part early in the book that there were some landscapes that made you feel patriotic.
Yes. And that would be North Dakota, strangely enough. The first time that I went to Theodore Roosevelt National Park, I was stunned by the viewscape. For as far as you could see, you know, badlands. And not like the South Dakota badlands, bare and raw and exposed, but a gentility of form with the vegetation, and yet this highly eroded, diverse landscape with prairie dogs and pronghorn and bison and wild horses. It just allowed me to reimagine what America must have looked like as settlers moved west. Even Teddy Roosevelt, at the hour of his own grief, where he lost his wife and mother on the same day. And that's where he left the East Coast to really allow himself to grieve at the Elkhorn Ranch. So deeply patriotic. I felt the same way at Big Bend, I have to say, and if I ever disappear, it will be there. Just miles and miles and miles of wildness, and right there on the border. And for those people, you know, anyone who's been to Big Bend National Park, the thought of a wall is, to quote Charles Bowden, not only absurd, but I think he said, quote, a fucking piece of performance art. You know, it can't happen. I mean, those walls rise upward like praying hands. They're immense in its rugged, dry country. When I was there, you know, you watched children from Mexico skipping stones to children in America. And at that time, it was ankle-deep water. Again, a different kind of patriotism, hoping to keep the open space of democracy open.
The kinds of conflicts that we're having over public lands now go way back. And I was actually surprised. I mean, there's a lot of history in this book. It's really quite enlightening. I was surprised to read the part about how in Grand Teton National Park in Wyoming, you tell the story of how John D. Rockefeller tried to donate land for that park. Franklin D. Roosevelt, who was president, hesitated. The whole process was very controversial. What did that look like then? What does it look like now?
I think we see that national parks are political, highly political. National monuments, many of them have been extremely controversial, as the one you mentioned, the Grand Teton National Monument, which was eventually absorbed into Grand Teton National Park. But yes, the stampede that took place, you know, in the late 40s, where someone like the former governor and senator, Cliff Hansen, led the stampede right through Grand Teton National Park in protest, saying, you know, here our American boys are fighting and losing their lives in Europe during World War II, and yet you're ripping the ground right beneath their feet. When Senator/Governor Hansen was in his 80s, very close to death, he said, I was on the wrong side of history, and Grand Teton National Park was the best thing that ever happened to our state. And, you know, I don't think there's any national monument or national park that has been looked upon regrettably through the eyes of history. And it makes me realize, and I think we all should take note, that when you hear the Utah delegation, their outcry over Bears Ears National Monument, 1.3 million acres, first monument led by an intertribal commission, the Navajos, the Ute Nations, the Hopi, the Zuni, that it doesn't represent Utah values, I think they're dead wrong, and they're in the pockets of the oil and gas industry, in the same way that they now want to rescind the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument that was made 20 years ago. We do have a history that shows us the protection of public lands benefits all of us as our public commons, a breathing space in a society increasingly holding its breath.
That is such a big part of the book, and really of both of your books, the deep importance of wilderness in public lands and the things that people talk about. I mean, they talk recreation and the economy and very important things like ecosystems and wildlife connectivity and things like that. But both of you also write about sanity, restoration of oneself, of one's soul. I think it was you, Brooke, who said that you shifted from the concept of being here to save wilderness to being saved by wilderness. And I wondered if you could each talk about that.
Yeah, for years, I worked on trying to find creative new ways to make the argument for wilderness. And a lot of people out there, old line wilderness advocates, have always maintained that we need to save the wilderness even if we never visit it, that we just need to know those places exist, the intrinsic values. And I agree that the intrinsic values are significant and very, very important. But I think the argument has been made a long time, and it's no longer as effective as it needs to be to expand the idea. And this idea of that we need to save the wilderness because it saves us, for me, it's all about evolution. We evolved in wild places, and we still are living in these wild bodies. Our bodies haven't changed much for 150,000 years, and yet we are forcing them to live in a world that's vastly different than the one they were designed for. And I really believe that there's a connection. When you are in a wild place, the wild part of yourself mixes with the wild landscape, and ideas and inspiration and possibly even answers to some of these massive questions that we've created are possible.
The national parks, national monuments, national lands, and there's so many different designations, we can't even like go into what those distinctions are, but they are protected, but they're not islands. They're inextricably connected to the land around them. And like in Theodore Roosevelt National Park in North Dakota, which you talked about, I mean, you're painting a picture of utterly out of control oil and gas development right around the park. And socially, it's almost like the 19th century California gold rush. And you go there with your father, whose life work was laying pipelines for oil and gas. What was that like? I mean, where did you and your father find points of common ground? Where did you diverge?
That's such a good question. My father had never been to North Dakota. Our family business, four generations, has laid pipe where natural gas would run through to heat our homes, subdivisions. And my family has worked in eight western states, never North Dakota. So my father was really interested in seeing what was happening in the Bakken. And we were there at its boom, where it was, I think, 1 million barrels a day. Now we're in the bust cycle of the Bakken. You know, so we would spend the days out with a dear friend of mine, Valerie Naylor, who at the time was the superintendent of Theodore Roosevelt National Park, and looking at these beautiful eroded landscapes, wind, the Little Missouri, you know, just gorgeous, gorgeous landscapes. And then Dad said, let's go see the Bakken. And once we left the boundaries of the park, you saw massive, you know, traffic of trucks with broken windshields, dust everywhere, signs of man camps, emergency care, laundry, liquor. I mean, you just saw the infrastructure that was creating this boom. We went into the man camps, and it was one of the most degrading things I've ever seen. 12 men in a storage unit with some, in some cases, no windows, and others just postage stamp size. You know, and my father was absolutely stunned, realizing the management cared nothing for these men. They were expendable. It became even more poignant because his son, my brother, had gone up to the Balkan hoping to make some money and get control of his life. In truth, it shattered his life, and he found himself on the streets. Brutal, absolutely brutal, and we witnessed that. And it really brought forth a lot of stories in my own father's life saying, you know, for years I always felt guilty that I couldn't afford to get motel rooms for our men when they were laying pipe in Evanston, Wyoming. And he said, I remember going to the Army Navy store and buying cots for all the men and sleeping bags and cooking gear. But he said, now I realize, you know, there we were in a circle underneath the stars telling stories. And the next day when we had to lay pipe and go beneath the river, we made record time because there was a camaraderie and they knew that they were loved. He used that word, loved. So those were the kinds of conversations we had. It got tense when all of a sudden conservation butted up against development. And my father, who is a lifelong Republican, just said, you know, Terry, you can't have it both ways. You know, we're driving up here. You use airplanes, you know, you fly on planes, and yet there has to be oil and gas. So what's the alternative? So it was, again, a dynamic conversation in a dynamic landscape and not without its heartbreak and disagreement.
Again, in this theme of, I mean, this is a book about relationships and the relationship between you and your father, very loving, sometimes tense, the relationship between him and the men whom he cared for. And, you know, he gave advice to a young person who was thinking about getting a job in this field doing energy development. And basically said, don't work for a company where you can't meet the guy in charge. And then the relationship between Valerie Naylor, superintendent of the park, and the heads of the fossil fuel companies, it was so interesting to me. She couldn't even go to the legislators in her own state. She couldn't go to elected officials to get them to protect the park. She had to go to the people in charge of the energy companies.
That was fascinating. She's a real hero to me. You know, she tells the extraordinary story of seeing on the list of lands to be developed for oil, the parcel directly next to Teddy Roosevelt's Elkhorn Ranch. And if there is anything about that ranch, it is about solitude and silence. And so she invited the CEO to come to the park, to go stand on that land that he wanted to develop and listen. And then she invited him to walk the path to where Theodore Roosevelt lived, his cabin where you still see the foundation stones. And she just waited for him. So several hours passed, he came back, and he said, how many people use this trail? What's the visitation here? And she said, one. And he said, no. What are the numbers? How many people come to this site? And she said, one. And I think what he realized was, it's one person, one experience, just as Theodore Roosevelt had his solitary experience. That's what you protect. It's not about quantity, it's about quality. And he made the decision to drill from another site diagonally underground so that that wouldn't be impaired. But, you know, she has since retired. She was exhausted. The new superintendent, who is also a woman, now is taking up the charge. But it is relentless. And I think the other thing I realized in researching this book, The Hour of Land, is conservation is a generational stance. It's not about winning. It's not about the outcome. It is literally every single day in the places we call home, whether they're iconic landscapes like Yellowstone or Yosemite or Acadia National Park or our own home ground in our communities. We have to be vigilant and really think about community in the largest, broadest terms, not just community for our species, but rocks, rivers, plants, animals, and human beings, seeing the world whole.
I often think of it as being like people who are doing that kind of protection are the immune system. You're never done. You know, the little cells in your immune system are never done getting rid of pathogens. You're always working.
Brooke talks a lot about that. And what you and Paul Hawken were talking about, right?
Yeah, that book of Paul Hawken's, Blessed Unrest, has that whole chapter on immunity. Right. And I actually wrote to him the other day and I said, I'm revisiting that because As you recall, that book is about all the organizations that are out on the planet that are doing social justice, environmental work, all of it. And it was about organizations. And I think that's really, really, really important. But even so, I feel like it's now each of us as an individual. What role do we play in that immune system of the planet? And in fact, if you look at what's going on, the administration that's currently in power is really anti-life. It's really like a disease if you look at it from a natural perspective, or an infection. And it really needs to be dealt with in that way, because everything they do every day is anti-life.
You both decided at a certain point to devote yourselves, I mean, in the sense of, okay, what can I do? What can we as a small group or individuals do to devote yourselves to keeping fossil fuels in the ground where you live, Utah? And you did something that was, I'm going to assume or ask you, was it inspired by the climate activist Tim DeChristopher, namely bought up some leases on public lands?
It was absolutely inspired by Tim. The difference is when Tim created his own act of civil disobedience by bidding up the oil and gas leases in 2008, the price of oil was at its all-time high. And he bid up, I think it was $1.3 million worth of oil and gas leases. It was an act of civil disobedience, not to be paid, but to be protested. And he, in fact, served 2 years in prison, a federal prison. When Brooke and I bought the leases, oil prices had dropped. We were able to purchase these leases on our debit card with fingers crossed that we would have enough money in the bank to do that. It was called a remnant sale, where, shockingly, we could purchase leases to public lands at $1.50 an acre. That's cheaper than a cup of coffee. And Brooke, you later were looking at social costs, which I think told another story.
Yeah, it was really interesting. It wasn't a plan that we had made going into this. It just, everything happened. All these sort of doors swung open and we kept walking through them, and ended up looking at the maps after the fact and finding parcels that mattered to us. And we had to go back and forth with the BLM because they were insisting that we needed to have the intent to actually drill on these leases, or it was illegal for us to own them. And in the end, they denied them to us because of that. But in the meantime, we said, we have no intent to drill on these leases until the price of oil guarantees that the social costs will be internalized. And what I mean by that is, right now, there's estimates that the social cost, meaning the coming hurricanes, the sea level rises, all these factors that we're aware of that climate change is causing, no one's paying for those. And we're passing those costs on to the future, to our children and grandchildren. And I was able to get in touch with an economist in Portland, Oregon, Eugene, Oregon, I think it was. And he's the one that has made all the calculations and determined that the amount of greenhouse gases that come from burning one barrel of oil. And when you start to think about that, then you can apply a social cost, which some people think is low as $50. Other people think is as high as $300
per barrel.
So that, there's a calculator that you can find that says, all right, if the cost of a barrel of oil, which right now is around $53, that goes to what, $2.40 a gallon at the pump, which is what we pay. Well, if you add $300 to the price of a barrel of oil, and then you calculate the price at the pump, it's like $13 a gallon that we would be paying if we were paying the accurate cost. And I think that, to me, is something that everyone can get their head around.
And I think that's when we said, you know, we will develop these leases when science can show us that the fossil fuels below ground are worth more above ground given the cost of climate. I think it's that question, Brooke, and I keep asking ourselves, you know, how serious are we? And just speaking with Larry Rasmussen, who's a great ethicist and, in my mind, spiritual elder, And he was talking about, let's name it, we are in the midst of a planetary tragedy, and this current Trump administration is doing everything in their power to undermine an ethical stance toward life, whether it's immigration, whether it's environmental protection, whether it's healthcare, equity. I think each of us, in our own way, with the gifts that are ours, again, in the places we call home, have to rise.
One of the things that I thought was so interesting, you were talking about this gas lease auction. You talked about the vile language they used to describe land. Who was speaking and what kind of things were they saying?
Again, closed doors. I happened to be there as witness. And the auctioneer, white, male, most of the people in the room were white, male. The vulgarity of language, the language of, you know, who's going to come? Let's come. Who's going to come? Let's, you know, don't let her go. I can't even voice what the language was. It was so hideous, so sexist, racist, abusive, you know, viewing the land that was up for sale as a woman.
To be raped, essentially?
Absolutely. And I was stunned. I was shocked. And you know, suddenly I just found myself, the tears streaming down my cheeks. I couldn't even, you know, try and calculate what the cost of this particular lease would be. All I knew is that this was a vile, secret society of abuse for the benefit of the few at the expense of the many. You know, going back, Mary Charlotte, to the national parks, I was stunned to learn that 40 of our national parks are at risk because of oil and gas development. 12 of those 40 already have oil and gas development inside them, with another 30 pending. So again, what do our national parks mean to us? And how can we make our voices count?
One of the things that I appreciated in the book, The Hour of Land, is the awareness that in all of this land of the national parks, well, all of the land of this continent, it was all once native land, and it was not empty, uninhabited wilderness, as some of the narratives would suggest. Tell us about places where Native American Indian influence and land management are coming back to these wilderness areas.
I think the most interesting that I saw is happening at Glacier National Park with the Blackfeet Nation and the National Park Service. Now, if you go up to Glacier National Park, you see three flags flying on the border of Canada and the United States. You see the United States American flag, you see the Canadian flag, and standing in the middle, you see the Blackfeet Nation flag. The superintendent of that national park is spectacular, and he is saying, you know, we are a national park named Glacier, where glaciers may no longer be part of our story. But what is part of our story is this idea of uncertainty. What is uncertain in terms of climate change? How our national parks can hold the ground in these places even as the glaciers are receding. And that with Indigenous people, with Native people, with the tribes, the Blackfoot Nation as an example, they can reintroduce, which they're thinking about, bison to Glacier National Park. That they can talk about co-management, and that the boundaries between the park and the communities now are starting to not only expand but dissolve psychologically. I think we're seeing the same kind of Native leadership with the Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition that we just spoke of, with the Zuni, the Hopi, the Navajo, the two Ute nations, in communication, in correspondence, in cooperative management with the Park Service, the Forest Service, the BLM. Is it messy? Yes. Will it take more time? Probably. But what do we gain in the process? We gain the wisdom, centuries old, traditional knowledge of what these lands mean, what the plants mean, how these are our medicines. Again, the health of the people, the health of the planet. And that these landscapes, the ancestral homes of Indigenous people, that when you are in that country, you can still hear the voices singing through the canyons.
There are, in both of your books, some really deep connections that you find, that you describe for yourselves. Like, Terry, you write about being in Acadia National Park in Maine, where you've always felt a deep connection. You use the word DNA, connection, even though you're from Utah. Then you find out that your actual ancestors lived exactly there. You meet some of their descendants. Brooke, you made a connection with an ancestor of yours, William Williams, who becomes kind of a companion to you in the wilderness. Another very deep connection. There's another story in the Hour of Land of Billy Lee, who's a Civil War reenactor you meet at Gettysburg National Military Park, who told you that a Civil War hero named John Lonergan, quote, reached out and grabbed my ankle and said, tell my story. And 10 years later, Lee put the biography that he wrote of Lonergan on Lonergan's grave. How do you understand these kinds of connections? How do they inform your work as conservationists, as human beings relating to these places?
I think that's a really good question. I'm not sure it's even one I can properly articulate. It's just that once I discovered this ancestor, and it was only as a means to find out where my homeland was, where my family came from, I was more interested in a place than I was a person. But it was as if there was a door that opened and strange things happened. I started paying attention to things differently than I had before, and who knows exactly what's going on, but I blame William Williams for making a big influence in my life. And I think it was the same with the Civil War reenactor. I think it's the same with your great-great-grandmother. I think these people, the quantum physicists are starting to understand that we live in many different realities, and the physical body that we have is only a small piece of who we really are.
And I think growing up in Mormon culture, you know, we were quote unquote commanded to know our genealogy. And, you know, as children, you'd yawn and then you'd be asked, all right, who is your mother, Diane Dixon Tempest? Who are your grandmothers, Catherine Blackett Tempest, Letty Romney Dixon? Who are your great grandmothers, Louis Mabin Dixon, Mamie Comstock Tempest, Florian Kazare Blackett, the late Lee Romney? You know, these were names that lived with us. And so I think Brooke and I are very comfortable with the dead among us. But, you know, when you look at Native people, one of the most fascinating, moving national parks that we went to, Effigy Mounds in Iowa on the border of the Mississippi River. It was there that we really saw, again, call it racism, call it abuse, but two of the former National Park Services, this is the shadow side of the National Park Service, literally ripped through burial grounds. Even the effigies in the shapes of bears and falcons with a 200-foot wingspan, sacred to the Winnebago people. Finally, they've been prosecuted on charges of felony. Boxes of bones of Native ancestors were kept in their garages. So, you know, that's the other side of the history of our national parks and Native people. Now there is a very powerful cultural anthropologist, archaeologist there, Albert Lebeau, who is Lakota, who has been making amends. And the place that was once a place of abuse is now a place of healing. So, you know, I think we're in this, again, I'm going to use the word dynamic time of consciousness. And even though I think so many of us are discouraged, I think the people on the margins, people of color, black people, brown people, you know, Native people, they're saying, welcome to our world.
Right.
You know, and I think as white people of privilege, it's time to listen. It's time to be good allies to those who understand what revolutionary patience is, and wisdom and dignity and strength. So I think even though it appears to be a dark time in the state of democracy in this country, I think it is an intense time of awakening. And consciousness does not go backwards. I do not believe that. I think we are going forward. And I think we're really, each of us in our own way, are finding out where we can be of use. There's a lot of work ahead of us.
I think part of that work, I mean, going back to this whole question of ancestors, is listening on levels that we're not usually used to listening, like not necessarily just in an analytical or solutions-oriented way, but, I mean, in the entire history of human beings, there have always been ancestors present, and there still are, if you believe in that kind of thing. And listening to that whole dimension, I mean, sometimes I imagine this whole world of ancestors who want to say something and nobody's paying attention.
I know, and how do they get our attention? You know, whether it's grabbing you by the ankle or in Brooke's case, you know, inhabiting your soul. I think for the last 10 years we've had a third placemat, you know, place setting for William Williams. But it makes for such a richer world. You know, I feel and can hear my grandmother's voice in my heart. You know, as a writer, I know my own vocabulary ad nauseum. But suddenly there's a fresh thought, and they're not my words. And I think, okay, who's trying to reach me here? And as Brooke said, you know, it's all about keeping the story going. And there are many stories.
And there are so many more stories from this work that we could share, but we're going to have to wrap up in a moment. One of the things that I got from reading the work in both of your books and thinking about the way you are approaching land and conservation and the reality of this situation, and looking inside myself too, is that there are so many entanglements. There's no sort of like pure good guys and pure bad guys. And I think you spoke, Terry, about Donald Trump being our shadow. And I mean, John D. Rockefeller gave this land to the federal government for national parks, beautiful thing. But that money was made in Standard Oil, which is responsible for, I mean, this whole petroleum industry that is the source of a big problem in the first place, climate change. And I look inside of myself, you know, my own consumerism or my own being entangled in this system. It's, I don't even know what the question is. Like, it's a tricky thing to untangle.
Well, I think the key word for me is complexity and add paradox. And we are, you know, with the media, you look at it's black and white, it's Fox News, it's MSNBC. And I think that does all of us a disservice. You know, you talk about Donald Trump being our shadow. My uncle would say it is his light. It's a beacon, finally. But I remember listening to the radio and listening to an interview with Gloria Steinem, whom I greatly admire. And the interviewer said, "Is Donald Trump your president?" And she said, "No, he is not my president." And I remember as I was sitting there washing the dishes, I thought, I disagree. He is my president. He is my shadow, alter ego. He is resides in me. I went through a series of having night after night after night dreams of Donald Trump until I was afraid to go to sleep. You know, I think we're all complicit. We're all part of this. And I think he's the perfect president for this time for us to really recognize we are a consumptive society. And his values are the values of this country right now. And I think we're at a turning point for the planet and for democracy, saying, is this who we want to be? And I register a resoundingly no. And so at the last dinner party that we had at our family, we were all grousing about Donald Trump. And finally, my youngest brother, Hank, who works in the trenches, a shovel as his tool of choice, said, look inside. Why are you projecting outside? Look within. That's where the change has to come. And I believe him.
And earlier, Terry, you mentioned consciousness does not go backwards. It goes forward. And I feel like we need to acknowledge that the Rockefeller family, you know, their oil companies, they did not drill for oil and sell it knowing it was going to destroy the planet. They now realize that it does, and they're making amends. I think the real tragedy comes when we feel like Donald Trump is right, where there is a time when America was great. Like, we have to go back to something. We don't go back. We can't go back. There's a consciousness that is on the move, and it's never going to be more dynamic than right now, and that's what we're trying to capture.
And maybe the future will be much more beautiful and surprising than we can even imagine right now.
Right.
It's sort of hard to think
or
that.
Or not.
Yeah.
You know, and I think this notion of outcome, I think if we can be as present as possible, as conscious as possible, as engaged as possible, then our future will be different than it is now. And we still have that choice.
There's one more thing I wanted to ask you before we go. A lot of people are involved in the resistance that you've both have been talking about. A lot of people who've never been politically involved before are getting involved. A lot of people are wondering what their role is, what they can do. Is bearing witness enough? What kinds of actions are effective? What is your both of your thinking on that right now?
My thought is that we all have inside us a clue to how the planet wants to make the best use of us. And I feel like bearing witness is the first step. I feel like we can't force ourselves to make big sacrifices for very long. I don't think sacrifice is a sustainable idea. But what we will find is that place inside us where we know what to do. And once we tap into that, what we do will not only be making a difference on a planetary level, but it will be the most meaningful thing, and we'll be happier and more energetic, and we will be more alive because of it.
I do think bearing witness matters. I don't think bearing witness is a passive act. I think it's an act of conscience and consequence. I think each of us, as Brooke is saying, in our own way has to find our way in. What are our gifts? How can we bear them up in the name of community? How can we give them up in the name of community? And each in our own way, each in our time, own time, with the passion that is ours. If each of us see ourselves as a part of that larger mosaic, then I think the design of democracy does deepen and change and sparkle, if you will. I think that action is an antidote for despair. I think beauty is its own form of resistance. I think it's really important we keep that in mind. With hands on the earth, we remember where our power lies. And I think the last thing, Mary Charlotte, is, you know, there are days where I feel like I can't even get out of bed, where I just wonder how do we go forward? But in those moments of despair, I'm aware of the limits of my own imagination. Imaginations shared create collaboration, and in collaboration, community is formed. And I honestly believe that in community, anything is possible. And that's what I think we're creating. These satellite communities that are deepening the concept of democracy, direct action, direct engagement, with a way forward that we can't even see yet.
Terry Tempest Williams and Brooke Williams, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Terry Tempest Williams is an award-winning author of many books, including her latest, The Hour of Land, A Personal Topography of America's National Parks. Brooke Williams is a longtime advocate for public lands. He's the author of Open Midnight, Where Ancestors and Wilderness Meet. In the time that we had to talk, we of course couldn't go into every single chapter of each book. You can find or order them at your local bookstore, and actually you can listen to The Hour of Land if you use audiobooks. Terry herself reads it in her beautiful voice. And I would like to say that her chapter on Gulf Islands National Seashore has some of the most incredible reporting I've ever read on the effect of the Deepwater Horizon spill. And the chapter on Alcatraz is about art and incarceration and Native American resistance. I mention these because we didn't get to talk about them, and they're so very important. If you want to find out more, you can go to Terry Tempest Williams' website, coyoteclan.com. You've been listening to The Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of The Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.